Cue Henry Mancini, please. Sunday night, and that means from high above beautiful Lake Osceola in downtown Jefferson Valley, New York, the John Mack Radio Show is on the air. Good evening, it's John McMullen, John Mack to some, welcome to the 283rd episode of the weekly John Mack Radio Show. The recording for the previous 282 shows may be found at www.johnmack13.com under the Radio Show tab. And John Mack is J-O-H-N-M-A-C. So that's www.johnmack13.com. In addition to the previous radio shows, you'll also find links to my online daily newsletter at my web home. The newsletter is a curation of 10 news articles from around the country and the world. Try it and subscribe. Only one email per day, and it's free. www.johnmack13.com. We have some great shows lined up continuing tonight. I hope you'll all join me next week at this time, when my guests will be poets and college professor Van Hartman. Before getting into tonight's conversation, some local Hudson Valley news. Writers in the Hudson Valley should be aware that every Thursday evening is the weekly meeting of the Mahopac Writers Group, now in its 22nd year, at 6:30 p.m. at the Mahopac Library on 6 in Mahopac. More than 150 books have been published by writers from this group. Once a month, the same group also has a morning meeting on the third Wednesday of the month. So July's meeting will be coming Wednesday, July 17th, at 10 a.m. at Coffee Time on 6N in the Red Hill section of Mahopac. There are also two poetry workshops in the area, one in Mahopac and one in Yorktown. The Mahopac one is held on the second Wednesday of each month at the Mahopac Library at 6:30, and the Yorktown one is on the fourth Wednesday at the John C. Hart Library in Treboke, New York, at 6 p.m. In Yorktown, the Yorktown workshop will meet July 23rd, while the Mahopac one will next meet on Wednesday, August 14th. The next open mic night at the wonderful Hudson Valley Writers Center in the Phillips E. Manning train station in Sleepy Hollow will be on Friday, July 19th, 7 p.m. The Hudson Valley Writers Center always has something going on, whether it be classes, workshops, open mics, open writes, or just get them together. You can get a full schedule of the activities there by going to Write Center, one word, WriterCenter.org. Anyone wishing more information on any of these meetings may contact me at johnmapp13@gmail.com. Now, to this week's show, I mentioned the 283rd in the series. Tonight, I am joined by Riot educator and poet Christina Ortolani. I first met Christina at the aforementioned Mahopac Writers Group a few years ago, and she now participates in all of the groups that I mentioned earlier. The listeners wishing to join Christina on the air may do so by calling 646-716-9756. That's 646-716-9756. I generally hold call participation until near the end of my conversation with my guest. Good evening, Christina. Welcome to the show.
Hi, John. Thanks for having me.
Would you start us off with the poem?
Sure. Since I know you love basketball and my son does too, I'm going to start you off with one called Squad. Thump, thump, thump. Swish, dunk. Basketball Friday in my driveway. Shuffle of feet, squeak. Young men's voices muffled and shriek. Scuffled and counting, posturing, posing for the cute girls across the street. Practicing their game, safe within their squad. Sweaty, dripping salt, stinky feet. I'm out, they halt. Pizza time, guzzling waters, easy laughter, square up, back to the game. Thump, 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 dribble and pass, lights come on, mom comes to the door. There better not be any water bottles on my lawn. No, ma'am. It's getting dark. Time to go home. Bye-bye. No more basketball thumping in my driveway.
I like it. I like it. How often are they there? All the time?
Oh, it was a regular thing for many Fridays. As long as the weather was nice, my son and his friends would be in my driveway, usually on Friday afternoon evenings. And he still has his friends that come over, but often I would come home from work and there'd be 7 or 10 of them all thumping around.
I know that as a young child, you moved around a lot due to your parents' professional life and then the family tragedy. Would you take us through where you did grow up and go to early school?
Well, I was born in Hawaii. My dad was a professor there, and then my mom got sick, so we moved back to New York when I was 2, and legend has it I threw up when we arrived. That was my opinion of New York after living in Hawaii. And then we, my mom passed away, unfortunately, when I was 5, so I lived with my grandma in Jamaica State after that for a little while my dad was figuring things out.
Your father, also an educator, grew up in Italy, taught in Japan and in the U.S. Is he trilingual, and are you multilingual?
Yes, my dad is multilingual. He was born in Rome and grew up in Italy and was his 11th child. Grew up during World War II, so part of what made him valuable is he listened to the radio and taught himself German and English and would talk to the soldiers to kind of help out with different things. And then when he fell in love with my mom, he came over here. So he taught in Australia for a while, and then he taught in the University of Hawaii, and then he was in Columbia, and then he made his career really at Brooklyn College. He was there for over 30 years in the theater department.
Now, hadn't he also taught in Japan also?
I'm sorry?
Didn't he also teach in Japan? I thought he also taught there.
Yes, he was in Japan for 7 years.
Now, did he learn that language also?
Yes. My dad learned Latin and Greek growing up with Italian, and then he went to school in Germany, in Munich, is where he got his master's and doctorate degree. He wrote several books in German, and then he learned Japanese and was a missionary in Japan. He also knows French, he knows Spanish, he knows a lot of different languages.
Yeah, he's a charming gentleman to the audience. I've met him a number of times, and he's a very interesting human being. Then you went to grammar school out on the island, or did you go in Manhattan?
My first couple of years, I went to Mary Immaculate in Jamaica State, and then in fourth grade, after my dad remarried, we moved out to Long Island, and I went to Fairfield Elementary School in Massapequa, and I finished all my schooling in Massapequa.
And in your high school years, were you also in Massapequa?
Yeah.
Did you write for a school paper or the literary journal while in high school?
Not in high school so much.
Do you remember what your earliest aspirations were to be?
I remember I always really wanted to be a teacher. When I was little and I lived with my grandma, she got me a chalkboard with all these different colored chalks. And I remember I would set up all the different animals and dolls, and they would be my class, and I would teach them from the chalkboard. But I always wanted to be a teacher. I just thought that would be fun. Maybe it was just a control freak coming out of me.
How about another poem before we go on?
Okay. This one is called While Angels Sleep. While angels sleep, my thoughts run deep. I'll write my prose while the little ones doze. While one toddler snores, I imagine opening doors into their dreams to sneak a peek at the inspiration that might leap from their peaceful sleep. Maybe they'll tell me about it when they wake, but for now, I'll enjoy this quiet break.
That's cute also. And what happened after high school?
Well, after high school, I wanted to go study at Cornell University, but I did not get in. And my mom taught at the same high school that I went to, my stepmom. So I did not want to go to college where my dad taught, and Brooklyn College was my safety school. So I hemmed and hawed because I didn't get in where I wanted to go, and I didn't want to go to Brooklyn. And finally my cousin came, and I had been going to Italy every summer when I was younger, since I was 9. So I was very close with my Italian family, my aunts and uncles and cousins over there. And my dad gave me a great gift, sending me over there all the time. So my cousin Lorenzo came over for a banking conference in, like, May and said, you know, there's this American college, John Cabot International College, and it's walking distance from our home. Why don't you come and you can study there and be an au pair and teach our kids English? So I did. I leapt at the opportunity to leave Massapequa and get rid of my Long Island accent. And I studied there for 2 years. I got my associate's degree from John Cabot. And then I reapplied to Cornell when I got in.
I'm a little confused by the name. Why is a school in Rome named after an English explorer known for his travels to what became America?
Well, his real name was Giovanni Caboto. He was actually an Italian who was an explorer. I don't know why they named, but they named the university after him. And it was an American university in Rome that was affiliated with Hiram College, which is in Ohio. So the credits that I took were in an English-speaking college, and the credits were transferable, which was very nice.
So I just learned something. I know that John Cabot sailed for England, but I didn't realize that he was an Italian.
No, it's Giovanni Caboto. Yeah, he was Italian.
Like Columbus.
A lot of explorers would sell their souls just because whoever would pay their way, that's who they became.
which is obviously what Columbus was. He was an Italian sailing to Spain because they paid for it. Did you have much difficulty adapting to the culture over there?
Well, I had been going every summer since I was 9. So I was pretty fluent with the language, and the summer culture being there all year long was different, but it was a pretty smooth transition. I felt very much at home there, and I really became quite fluent. So, I mean, it's not perfect, but it's pretty good.
Were you still focused on becoming a teacher? And did you always want to teach young children the way you do now?
Well, I took many languages when I was in high school. I took Italian, I took Russian, I took German, I took Italian and Spanish. And so it's kind of similar to my dad. I have a faculty for languages and accents. But I didn't really use it much afterwards. My first job in college, I got a job as a simultaneous translator. And my associate's degree was in social sciences, and my psychology professor got me this position translating for the international behaviorist to the Italian psychoanalysts, and they were having this conference, and I had to translate simultaneously between the two groups, which was an eye-opener for me. I was very young and naive, and a bunch of old psychiatrists, and they had a lot of fun throwing different words at me and different scenarios at me and watching me squirm.
That must have been tough doing simultaneous translation, though.
Yeah, it was fun. It was a lot of fun.
And then you went to Cornell. Tell me about your Cornell experience.
Well, I really wanted to go to Cornell because Yuri Bronfenbrenner was there. And I had read his book, The Two Worlds of Childhood, and he was studying and writing a lot about cross-cultural studies and education and how educational systems were very different in different countries and comparing how that was an outcome for the students. And that was really fascinating to me, and that's what I really wanted to study, because I saw the Montessori method being used in Italy when I was there, and I saw the Catholic school that I went to, and I compared it with the public school system that I grew up in, and I knew that there was something fundamentally there that we could learn from, taking the best from other countries, and I thought that would be a really fascinating thing to study. So that's why I went to Cornell, and I did take a few courses with Professor Bronfenbrenner, and actually it was like the highlight of my thing, that he shook my hand and knew who I was as I was graduating. He's a fascinating man with a beautiful family.
After graduating from Cornell, you went right into early childhood education for 2 years, but then left the field for a number of years before returning. Was that due to the contraction of opportunities because of less children? And what brought you back?
Well, I did. I went right to working for Rockefeller University Children's School on the Upper East Side, and that was a wonderful opportunity working with international kids who were all children of the scientists that worked at Rockefeller University. And I worked there for a year, and that was just a one-year contract where I was subbing for somebody who was out on maternity leave. So then I got a job on the Upper West Side at the Mandel School, and that was also a very elite nursery school. We had the children of very, very elite people whose parents we very rarely saw. It was always the nannies who picked up the kids. We never saw their fancy parents. But then I took a break for a little while, and I ended up working at the North Shore University Hospital because I needed to make some money. I needed to take a break. I needed to make some money. And while I was at the hospital working at the cardiology department, that's when I was introduced to my husband. So then I ended up in New Rochelle.
Okay. And when I first met you, much of your writing focused on young adulthood, including the group of children's stories centered around Turtle and Bird. Could you tell us about that sequence of stories and also whether you have written other things for that market?
Sure. Well, I worked after my husband and I split up and we ended up in Mayapack. A couple of years before that, I started working at the Country Children's Center. And I started there as the nature lady. So I was teaching science and nature to kids from toddler age all the way up through fifth grade. And then I became a full-time pre-K teacher and really enjoyed working with three, four, and five-year-olds and helping them do some bibliotherapy and finding the right books to help them make sense of what different scenarios they might be going through in their home life. So I do believe very much in lighting that fire for reading. Not so much, you know, this is Dick and Jane and See the Dog and all those kinds of didactic kinds of reading things, but more like, oh, what are you interested in? You like trains? Let's go find a book about trains. And they are captivated by the pictures, and they like the story about the subject. And then from there, they really love reading, and they want to find more books about the subjects that they're interested in. So Turtle and Bird was kind of born out of that, because growing up, my mother fed the birds, and my grandmother fed the birds, and I always loved watching the birds outside the window. And my grandmother and my birth mom were very good about coming up with stories and sort of magical thinking. And so that's how this story came about. Originally, I was trying to explain to my daughter and her girlfriend, because they were frustrated with a guy situation, and I made the analogy. I said, well, you know, guys are a little bit like turtles and girls are a little bit like birds, and they're just different, you know, and you can't get mad at a turtle for being a turtle, just like a turtle can't get mad at a bird for being a bird. And then it just sort of blossomed from there.
Now, you've broken the story into four portions for each of the seasons. You've read Turtle and Bird to the writers group. We've discussed it as an illustrated series of four books. You've also presented as a public play to children to a good response. I can also see it as an audio book. Have you focused on what you want to do with it, at least to start?
Well, at this stage, I am tentatively looking for a publisher or an agent. Honestly, there's only so many hours in the day, and I've been working a lot on poetry, so that's kind of taken over, and I've let Turtle and Bird sit for a little bit. But I do want to get back to it this summer and see if I can at least have a conversation with somebody who's in the industry and how to start launching it, because the manuscript is pretty much done. Like you said, it, you know, it's broken down into spring, summer, winter, fall, and then the following spring.
Now, the coordinator of Fitting to Quino had recommended that you speak to a woman who's was an illustrator. Have you, is that what do you want to do with it, to have an illustrated book, or do you want to just have a textbook? How do you want to, and what age group are you shooting with?
Well, I have two different ideas. One is to sort of go the route of Charlotte's Web, Wind in the Willows, where it would be like a chapter book with minimal illustrations. And the other one would be more geared towards younger readers with better illustrations. And I haven't decided if it's going to be like photography quality so that it's a science kind of story, or if it's more illustrated. And I've got several people who are really good drawers, illustrators. So, but I've also been cautioned that sometimes you really, when you go to an editor or a publisher, they'll come up with their own illustrators and pair you together. So you have to be kind of careful. You don't want to say, well, I want this, because they have their own ideas too.
You mentioned poetry, and obviously you read two poems already. How long ago did you first explore other platforms such as poetry or novel writing or short story writing?
Well, I've kept a journal pretty consistently ever since I was in fifth or sixth grade, on and off, but I pretty much kept a journal. I write to make sense of the world, and so there's snippets of poems and stories that I've written over time. I've always been writing. I can always remember writing, but I never really thought about publishing anything. It was always more just for my own consumption until I went to the writers group, and then people like yourself and Vinny were like, hey, this is good. You should share it. You should do something with that.
Oh yeah, there's so many opportunities. I recommend it to everyone. Duotrope, which is a for pay $5 a month, but it's a database of all the submissions and all the possible places you could send things. And there's a weekly list of new editions and of new themes that people want and of agents. And also of people who have had things accepted in the previous week. And just in the last week, the woman who coordinates our Mayapak poetry group, Anne Brown, mentioned that she had the poem published in that coffee journal, because there was a theme that came up that she noticed in Duotrope. And they already had a theme for coffee poems, and she submitted, and she wound up with a published poem. Then 2 days later, I got something saying that I had something published in a literary journal that I almost forgotten it. I sent it to, and I also had forgotten if I ever knew that it's an Indian publication, not American Indian, but Asian Indian. So I've got four poems in this journal, and when I went to it, some of the other poets are from Australia or from the United States or from Canada, and it was all because we just happened to find this on Duotrope. So I recommended that to all our listeners. It's Duotrope.com, and it's well worth looking.
To get over my fear and just start submitting things.
Well, one of the hardest things for a person that has no experience is the rejection. I constantly get rejected either because it just didn't fit in a particular issue of that, or the editor doesn't particularly, they like what you do, but some other editor does. I had a T.R. Hummer on the radio show, who is the former editor of the Kenyon Review, and he was published in the New Yorker for years. And I mentioned to him, you've been published in the New Yorker. That's very hard to get into. So he said, well, there was an editor who liked my stuff. But then he left, and the next guy didn't. I never got published there. Now I have a new editor, and he apparently liked my stuff again. So it's a, you get rejected much more than you get accepted. And some people have a hard time with rejection, and then they stop. Or other people don't do the homework. Like, they'll write this great poem about basketball. And where do you want that published? Well, I've sent it off to something. No, they only publish scientific poems. Oh, I didn't know that. But they get the rejection, right. And they don't understand that they didn't do the homework on what the various places are. And that's why Duotrope is terrific, just to do that. Even if you're not presently publishing, just get familiar with it. It's a tremendous resource. But speaking of poetry, would you give us another poem?
Okay. Hold on one second. I had it up and now it's... Okay, well, this is one of my favorites that I wrote for our friend Bob Graslow that some of you all know. It's called Can We Agree? And I dedicate it to my mom. What I meant to say was not exactly what you heard. Maybe my words were unclear. What did you hear? Oh, you understood? Good. Yet we disagree? Oh, gee. So then, do we circle around, try to find common ground, or just go our separate ways, shaking our head in dismay? Your eyes and ears over there have such a different view from where I am here. I cannot hear or see it from your point of view, and I wonder, is it necessary that I do? Do we have to come to have the same point of view? Is it possible to have empathy even when we disagree? My mommy used to say, what a boring world that would be if everyone was perfect, same as me.
Yeah, I'd heard that. I've heard that before, and I really like that. I just got a note from Bob. Bob Zaslav, for the audience, is a longtime member of the Mohopac, the writers group, and he's also a playwright, and he's also a songwriter, and he's written books for children. He was a high school teacher, and he moved out to the state of Washington. He just sent me a note that historians have determined the actual quote about Paul Revere. One if by land, two if by sea, and three if in the air.
Oh, wow. Yeah, you never know.
So.
Oh, yeah.
So you seem to be going to all these various groups, and you seem to be writing a lot. Has that you mentioned that you haven't gotten back to Turtle and Bird? Has poetry just grabbed you by the arm and held you?
Recently, yes. It kind of goes in waves. I think what I've learned about writing is that sometimes you need to let a story kind of sit and get some distance from it, and then you can come back to it. Same with poems. So that's what I've been doing. Right now it just seems like it's a nice venue to be able to go to these different poetry workshops and poetry readings. Today I was at Thompson's Corners, and they have the Poet's Corner the second Sunday of every month. And we had it outside, and it's absolutely beautiful. It's just a perfect setting for it.
Yeah, you have been going on a regular basis to a great place, the Curly's Curly's lineup.
Yeah,
and Stanford.
Ralph Nazareth. Yep.
That's been meeting almost as long as our brightest group for 21 years, and he's a terrific person, and some of the people from this group have been featured poets there, so it's a very nice place. And then of course there's all the ones that I mentioned. Have you ever taken any courses in writing?
Not that I'm trying to think if I took one in college. I don't think so. I don't think I ever took like an official poetry class or anything like that. I mean, I've read poetry. My grandmother was an English teacher. My aunt was an English teacher. I come from a family of people who are constantly correcting grammar, and so just all educated. So it kind of came to me via osmosis. My birth mother was a poet, and so there's always kind of been books of poems kind of lying around. The New Yorker was always around. But it was never kind of something that I officially studied or read, or, you know, it's kind of something that came to me. I like to rhyme things. It was always just kind of fun. I love Dr. Seuss. I like rhyming stories for kids.
You mentioned bibliotherapy before. That's the term that Vinnie D'Aquino used a number of times. And one of the amazing things about the writers group is that the people have built such a trust in other people in the group, knowing that the criticism will be aimed at improving their stuff, not at putting them down or it down. To have had two widows, one write about her grief, and another write about her anger when her husband died. We've had a woman who lost a child to narcotics, write about her grief, and then all of a sudden, after writing about that for about a year and a half, saying, okay, I'm moving on now, I'm putting it behind me, and she's written different funny things about growing up in the Italian family and the cooking and everything, and just so it seemed that people are willing to expose themselves in ways that you wouldn't really think when you joined a group like that. We're complete strangers.
Well, I know we're both at Curly's and at the Mayor-Pack Writing Group. There is the sense of safety and intimacy because it's the same core group that's pretty much there week after week, and you grow to really trust these people. It's like an extended family. I mean, you know, my husband also died about 3 years ago, and I went through some health issues, and I have to say the people in the writers group were there for me in a way that my own extended family sometimes just couldn't be. And writing for writers, but even for non-writers, is often very, very therapeutic. It's a good way to get things out.
Yeah, I agree completely. But the various types of writing can play a for you, and with also your teaching responsibilities, how did you budget your time, if you do?
Well, sleep is always expendable. depends. It really depends. I mean, when I'm wrestling with an idea, oftentimes the writing happens late at night. When I'm working and I have to be up early in the morning and functioning, I try to carve out time during the day where I just go to the library and sit at the computer and work for 2 or 3 hours, because I do have a break in the middle of my day. Now that my kids are older, it's a lot easier because they're much more self-sufficient. But it is. It's a balancing act, and that's why sometimes things don't get published or stories lay there waiting for life because you just can't do it all. There's only 24 hours in a day, 7 days a week. So
you've also had a serious health problem and the hip replacement and you were confined to the house or to not being able to drive for a while. Were you able to turn that time into writing time, or was it too painful with the physical things going on and physical therapy?
First of all, your wife was amazing, but she just drove me a whole bunch of places, as was Priscilla. I don't know what I would have done without the two of them. But I did do a lot of writing. If I couldn't have written, I think I would have totally gone out of my mind. I did a lot of processing of things. I wrote a lot of poetry and worked on Turtle and Bird a lot. And I was pretty prolific during that period of time when I was home as much as I could, because it was a good distraction from pain and whatnot.
Have you been? I haven't seen any writing that you've talked about the physical pain experience or the operations. Have you gotten into that? Have you written about that at all?
Yes, I have. I'm trying to remember what it's called. One is called Mercurial Misery. What's the other one? Oh, In My Dreams. Which one would you rather have? I like In My Dreams.
Whichever you'd like.
Hold on, let me get In My Dreams. Flip it around on my computer.
That one I do know, yes. Yes, and I like that one.
But In My Dreams. In my dreams, nothing is impossible. Nothing hurts. I can move quickly, gracefully, painlessly. I can hike and bike and dance naturally. In my dreams, I have enough energy to accomplish all I need and want to today. My home is clean, the laundry is done, healthy meals effortlessly served, the dishes are done. My garden thrives, no weeds, only flowers outside, and my children are a constant source of pride. In my dreams, I am the model of kindness, patience, organization, and creativity. Then I wake to reality, where my body conspires against me. Pain and inflammation reign over my parade daily. It ripples to cripple my ability to participate in any activity. Forget hiking, biking, skiing, or dance. The only marathons I'll win are napping and Netflix. I have limited bursts of energy I guard and spend warily. Household chores I must delegate. Relying on others, I must patiently wait. Outside, my garden survives, wild with weeds. My children do as they please. The strange lady in the mirror doesn't look like or feel like me, and this isn't who I want to be. So for now, I'll close my eyes and return to my dreams.
That's a great line. My body conspires against me. So many people have various things like that, and it's almost like you're separating the spirit of who you are to yourself and who you want to be from the physical ailments that you have, whatever they are. You know, and I really like that. Now, it's obvious what triggered that subject matter. What normally triggers what you're writing about? Do you know, or are just things that pop into your head, or
it could be anything. It really could be anything. There's another poem that I wrote, and it was just about missing my husband and the weather. So it was the weather that inspired me and a memory. Sometimes it's just something in nature that I see. Sometimes it's an interaction between people. There's all kinds of things that just catch my interest, and then I'm like, maybe I could play with that phrase or that idea and turn it into a poem. And sometimes it works, sometimes it doesn't.
What about the prompts that we get from someone like Anne Grau at the Mahopac poetry group. Have you done anything like that, trying to just write on the subject that people tell you about, rather than something that you come up with yourself?
I have done things that way in the past. I usually am woefully unprepared, and I always forget my homework, so I usually don't end up doing what Anne tells us to do. So I forget until I show up, and I'm like, oh, that's right, we were supposed to do that.
I think that the last meeting that we had last week was the best that we ever had, by the way.
Yeah,
I thought that was.
I mean, I really like the way Anne helps us work on the mechanics of poetry, which is something that I don't know much about, and I could use a lot of help with in terms of the meters and the rhyming schemes and the length of the poem and trying to put the ideas into a format that then becomes classical.
Yeah, that's, for instance, this found poetry is completely unusual to me, taking things from a book or from a newspaper and only using those words, only using those ideas. And prose poetry is very different from anything that I was experienced with. So, what's next for you?
I hope to just keep being part of the local poetry circuit. I enjoy sharing my work, and I'm hoping to get some poems published. I'd like to get Turtle and Bird actually in the hands of teachers and kids. And I have a few other stories. I wrote one about a three-headed dragon, another one about a little boy, Jake, and the magic fish in the lake. I'd like to work more on those and try and see them come into actual books.
Yeah, I think that the writers' groups really helps us to sharpen our skills. At the meeting last week, I talked about just the recommendations that I had from people for the night before at the poetry workshop that I thought made a poem that I thought that I was happy with much better after applying their recommendations. And I think that there's other people like Lenny who have really come along over the years. In the beginning, he was reluctant to read, he was reluctant to write. Now all of a sudden he's writing short stories and he's doing all sorts of things, and I think it's been good for you, and I think it's been good for Priscilla, and I think it's been good for me. So.
Well, I think it helps to have a supportive tribe, and I also think it's important to have constructive criticism from people who know their craft. I mean, Anne is a poetry teacher. She reviews poetry journals. She's really in the whole mix of this. And you're a poet laureate. And there are some people who really are out there publishing books. Like Vinny just put his book out there. So when you're sort of traveling with these people who are not only having fun by writing, like I always considered, well, this is just for fun, but are maybe even making a living a little bit, or, you know, certainly making a difference out there by putting their voices out there. It's very encouraging to them think, hey, well, maybe I could do, maybe my little contribution could help too.
Yeah, that's the big thing is I think poetry, we tend to write for ourselves. Other things, we want to tell our stories to the people, but poetry has that double edge. It would be interesting if people liked it, but in many cases, it's more important that we get to write it or improve it, or do whatever for ourselves. We've touched a lot of bases tonight. What else would you like the audience to know about you?
Well, I think that we often don't know how much we're capable of until we're really tested, and I've certainly done a lot of different kinds of things, but I've always had a theme with working with kids. But it's nice now that I'm doing different things. I'm really enjoying the writing and being with adults and working in a different venue, not just working with the little kids, and that's nice.
Well, I'm glad that you are doing it with us. Thank you very much. It's been a real pleasure. Would you take us off with another poem?
Sure. I'll do one last poem. And one thing that made me think with Ralph Nazareth is he talked about the essentials, that in a poem, if it's really grounded in the detail of your own life, you often hit on a universal. And a good poem, the sign of a good poem, is always one that makes you think. It makes you want to discuss it more. So, I can't find what I wanted to look. I wanted to read. Hold on. What is it? Hold on, I've got it. Oh, Define Good. This is the one I wanted to read. Okay. It's called Define Good. A pale green ceramic mug sits on my desk holding my pens and stuff. It dares me daily to define good with its bumpy beige inscription. Purchased at Goodwill on a whim for $2, it appeals to my sassy, sarcastic side. And yet, should a tyke reply to Sansa's inquiry, "Have you been good?" Define good. Now that would be considered sassy, naughty even. And yet, defining terms helps eliminate confusion and may be the perfect question. Parents, teachers, and children discuss what quote-unquote good looks like much. And yet, grown-ups need help too. Some recite the Ten Commandments or refer to wedding vows, perhaps citing legalese or the simple golden rule may be a tool. And yet, what's good to me might not be exactly what's good for you. So my mug stares back at me. Define good. I dare you.
It's obvious, too, by the way, that when we say at these groups that it's very important for us to read the poetry, because we get such, and you just did it, such tremendous voice inflection and pauses and everything like that, that very often people don't get it from reading it on the printed page. Now, it's very important. Obviously, more people get to read things on the printed page, but I think the whole voice thing, and people always recommend, and I don't do it often enough, that we should read our own poetry out loud, and we should listen to it, and then we might make some changes, but... So, I don't know.
Well, I also like it when other people read your work, because then you can really hear, because they're just reading the words on the page as they see them, and the pauses as the grammar is there. And so when you have somebody else read it and you listen to it, all of a sudden, then it becomes evident, oh, that's not exactly. Or if you read it out loud, you might automatically correct something that isn't written there. So it's helpful to have other people read your work as well.
We even find that at the writers group, when people will be reading their own work, and they make corrections without realizing it as they read, and then you have to point out, no, you didn't say the, you said there, you know, or something like that, you know. So it's that's interesting. But once again, Thank you very much, Christina.
Well, thank you for having me. It's been a lot of fun.
Send any comment or questions to me about the show at johnmack13@gmail.com. And be sure to join us next week with poet and college professor Van Hartman. Go to my website, www.johnmack13.com, for URLs of previous shows, the schedule of upcoming shows, and a bit of commercial information. My books are available at Amazon. Now, in the words of Mets radio announcer Howie Rose, after the Mets went, put it in the book. And until next time, as they used to say in the old neighborhood, see ya. Let's go off once again with the Eagles. Amazon, play Taking It Easy.
Take It Easy by Eagles, starting now on Amazon Music.
My load, and it feels on my mind. Don't need one, just a friend of mine. Take it easy.
Don't let the sound of your own wheels drive you crazy.
Thanks again, Christina. Good night, everybody. Thank you.
Thank you, John. Good night.
Arizona.